My apologies. I was just meditating on the deep and secret mysteries of the dividend discount models. Yes. Welcome to our final presentation on stock valuation, Chapter 6. And we're going to continue with the discounted cash flow model, which is another version of a dividend discount model. It's certainly my favorite. And this one, starting on slide 35, uses the present value of expected dividends and the present value of the expected future price of the stock to value a share of stock. Huh? Well, okay. Okay. Do you remember in our previous presentation, we used the future dividends that the company is going to produce to come up with a valuation of the stock? Well, this one does pretty much the same thing, but it also says, look, the stock is still worth something once they've paid us dividends for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Unlike the pure form that the book introduced, where we had 3 years of $100 dividends, and then the company promptly went out of business. No. We're going to take those dividends for the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years at the most, and we're going to then also add to that this value, what we believe the value of the share of the stock will be in 3, 4, 5 years. Now, again, as we said in the previous presentation, do we have any pretense, any notion that the numbers that we come up with are actually going to be the real numbers or what's going to happen in the future? No. What we're doing with this model and all these dividend discount models is simply tilting the odds in our favor, in my humble opinion. Because when you use these models, the companies that keep showing up the most are the ones that have been around a long time, have their roots deep in the economy, have been paying dividends, and have been growing those dividends over many years. So you're not going to be investing in a whole lot of startup companies that are, you know, have this promising new technology that could make you rich, but then fall down into the porcelain oasis. You're going to be buying companies, as we said, that have the roots deep in the economy, that Peter Lynch called the stalwarts. And we're not going to get rich fast. But unless the world ends, we're going to get rich. Now, is it a guarantee? Of course not. Do companies blow up and disappear? Yes. But these are far less prone to having untoward, unintended results. Okay? So, the unfortunate also situation is this is not covered in our text. Specifically, I wish they did, because it's my favorite dividend discount model. And with the other dividend discount models, this model is very sensitive to our estimates and our choice of the required rate of return, and hence, we say can be, we should say will be, very far off the mark. You ready to get started? Good. Slide 36. Here's an example. Now, I want you to do this, folks. Get a piece of paper out. Actually, you might want to wait until the next slide because we're going to make it look a little bit better, but let's assume it's January 1st, 2018, and Pretzels Unlimited is currently selling for $22 per share. Now, we expect them to pay $2 of dividends in this year, 2018. And then next year, we expect the dividends to increase to $2.20 in 2019. In 2020, we think it's going to be $2.30, and in 2021, we think it's going to be $2.30. Now, what if we think we're going to be selling the stock at the end of 2021, and we expect the price to be $27 per share? Our required rate of return is 12%. Well, we go back to the model and we say that the present value of the future dividends plus the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell is equal to what we believe the stock is worth. So we use that present value multiplier table. Do you have it out? And let's go through it, and then you could do this now. You could pause it and do it and do it, but I'm going to show you a little way, a better way, I think, to write these out so that it's easier to see. But let's say $2 this year times 0.895. I'm sorry, 0.893. I'm sorry. That's go across to 12% on the present value table down 1 year, and it should be 0.893. That's 2018. 2019, $2.20 is what we expect the dividend to be. Go across to 12% down 2 years, 0.797. For 2020, it's $2.30 we expect the dividend to be. And we go across to 12% down 3 years, and it's 0.712. For 2021, in year number 4, we believe that the dividends are going to level off and be at $2.20 still. And we go across the 12% down 4 years, 0.636. Now, those are the dividends. But remember, the stock price, they didn't go out of business, or at least hope they don't go out of business in 4 years. And the stock is, say, worth $27 then. Well, that's a cash flow 4 years into the future. So we go across the 12% down 4 years, and these two are the same. And people, what happens? They go down to year five. No. That would be 2022. So these two are the same, and that confuses people. But if you do all those calculations, you find that the stock is worth, we believe, at 12%, $23.81. So since the stock price is $22, we think it's a pretty good stock to buy, assuming everything turns out the way we expect it to, which we know isn't going to happen. Slide number 37. Now, here's where I said wait until the next slide before you did all the calculations, because if we make it into a table, I think it's a whole lot easier to do the calculations. Do you see? You write the years here, and then the cash flows. These are the cash inflows. $2 in the first year from dividends, $2.20 in the second year. In year number 3, $2.30. Year number 4, $2.30. But also in year number 4, $27 from the sale of the stock, because that's a cash flow, right? If we sell the stock, we're going to get the value of the stock, and we're assuming it's going to be $27. There are all the present value multipliers, and again, these both are in 2021, 0.636. So the $2.30 from the dividends and the $27 are both multiplied times the present value multiplier for year number 4. And we come up with $2.81 or so, right? And I think it's easier to comprehend and calculate in this format. But let's go one step further. On slide 38, you see we've moved the dividends and the price of the stock in 2021 together. Now, if I'm going too fast, just stop, go back and listen to it again and watch it again. This just makes it easier because we don't have to do we save a couple of additions in the multiplication, right? So here's 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021. $2 we receive from the dividend in 2018, $2.20 from the dividend in 2019, $2.30 from the dividend in 2020, and then $2.30 from the dividend in 2021 plus the expected price of the stock, which we don't know is going to be 27, but let's guess it's 27. That is $29.30, and then we only have to do 4 multiplications for the present value multipliers. The present value multiplier for year number 1, the present value multiplier for year number 2, year number 3, year number 4. And we get the same $23.81. And if I went too fast, stop it, go back and go do it again, because it's really not that hard, folks. I mean, it's just a bunch of numbers that you have to multiply and then add up. Adding the dividend and the stock price together in the last year saves us a couple of manual calculations. But more importantly, dear students, it also allows us to use a special spreadsheet function to calculate the internal rate of return. Slide 39. Now, sometimes you'll see people write it as IRR. The internal rate of return is a measure of what rate of return we expect to get from a series of cash flows, including positive and negative flows. Huh? In other words, positive cash flows are money coming into us, but negative cash flows are money that we have to put out. We have to pay. In other words, we don't get the stock for free. We have to pay the price of the stock in year number zero at today. Someday, when you take an upper level or graduate finance or investment class, you will learn how to manually compute internal rate of return. Someday. Hopefully, you will not have a sadistic professor who will require you to calculate it manually more than once. Because manual, it's not that hard, it's just very tedious, and that's why we have computers. You don't have to do tedious calculations. We got these handheld devices, these laptops that do it all for us. We are simply going to enter the numbers into a spreadsheet formula and press the enter key, okay? In other words, we required a 12% rate of return from Pretzels Unlimited. But what do our cash inflows and outflows, what do our numbers tell us will be our expected rate of return? Slide 40. See, if we type this into Microsoft Excel, or Google Docs, you know, type it into their spreadsheet, or whatever spreadsheet, Open Office or LibreOffice, we can use this special formula here. And you type in the years, and you type in the cash inflows, but you also have to add the cash outflow. You have to add the fact, see, it's a negative number. Our initial outlay is $22, so we enter that as a negative number because we had to pay to get. We don't get the stock for free unless somebody gives it to us, right? The spreadsheet formula is the equals IRR, the block of values. That's from whatever cell this is down to here. So if this is A and B, column A, column B, and this is row 1, 2, 3, 4. So you see it's column B2 through B5. B2, B3, B4, B5, B6 it should be, right? I goofed. That's not right. B2, B3, B4, B5 it should be B6. I got to go back and change that. Oops. Nobody caught that, huh? I didn't catch it. And then and then what you do is you put what you believe the rate of return is. You can actually leave it zero, and the computer will try to figure it out. But I think I put down 12%. So our initial outlay is $22, and then we get $2 in 2018, $2,000 in 2019. I'm sorry, did I say $2,000? $2 in 2018, $2 and 20 cents in 2019, $2 and 30 cents in 2020, and then the $2 and 30 cents plus the $27. Proceeds from being able to sell the stock for what we believe it's going to be worth, $27. And the spreadsheet tells us that, hey, you're not going to get 12%, you're going to get 14.51%. Assuming this all works out the way we think it's going to work out, and that's a big assumption that we know is wrong. We don't know what's going to happen. We're doing our best guess and seeing if we get it even close. And if we get it close, we're still going to do pretty darn well, in my humble opinion. Slide number 41. So that was an example where we have dividends coming in. And now that's problem number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I think, in the worksheet. But you'll see, you'll do the worksheet. So do the worksheets. Do them over and over and over again, and then the assignment is the same, in the same order, and then the exam will be the same, in the same order, okay? So here is an example now on slide 41, where we have a company that doesn't pay dividends. So look, Here, genes or us? Did you hear what the two chromosomes, the one chromosome said the other chromosome? Do these genes make me look fat? Anyway, genes or us is currently selling for $21 per share. It doesn't pay any dividends. Well, it's a biotech startup trying their best to make it into the big times. We believe that Genes R Us will sell for around $50 a share in 5 years. Why? Because they have this awesome biotechnology, and they're going to change the world, and they're going to cure cancer, and they're going to make it so that we can change our hair color, but just by eating some strawberries or whatever. I mean, it's going to happen. I don't know when. I don't know how. I know we're going to make a lot of money, and some investors are going to lose a lot of money because not all these companies are going to survive, but it's going to happen. And our required rate of return is 13%. Well, how can we determine if this is a good investment for us? Well, with no dividends, we can't use the previous dividend discount models, but we can still use the discounted cash flow model. Huh? Well, if you remember, the value of a stock according to the discounted cash flow model says that it's equal to the present value of the future dividends. Well, that's easy. Nothing. It's not paying any dividends and probably won't pay any dividends for years if it ever is able to pay dividends, if it ever survives. Someday it'll pay dividends, but for the next several years, no, it's still losing money. It's still trying to make it into the big leagues. But it's also equal to the present value of the stock when we plan to sell. So we think 5 years, it's going to be worth $50. So the formula becomes zero because there's no value from no dividends. But $50 times the present value multiplier for 5 years at 13%. So go across the 13%, down 5 years. Hey, you could go down 5 years and then across the 13%. It's up to you. And that turns out to be 0.543. So we believe the stock is worth $27.13. It's selling for $21, so hey, it's potentially a good buy for us. But, folks, are you starting to understand the difference between Genes R Us and Philip Morris or 3M or Honeywell or Target or Coca-Cola or McDonald's? Yeah, you see the difference? And this, more than anything else this semester, folks, this is what we want you to understand. That sure, you can invest in a company like this, and you may do really, really well. But the odds are against you. Because here's a company that's not making any money, and is fighting other companies that are not making any money, and one of them is going to do really well. So what do you do, buy all five or whatever? And then some other company that nobody even heard of comes out from the blue. So this is the kind of investing that I hope you do very little of. Go ahead. For every five Johnson & Johnsons and 3Ms and Coca-Colas, buy one Genes R Us or one Amazon or one Tesla. Because those kind of companies, yes, they can make us rich really quickly, but they can make us very sad, whereas 3M ain't going to make you rich overnight, but it also isn't going to fall into a pool of tears and dissolve. Well, some of them do. You ever hear Kodak or Enron? Okay. So even with the big companies, there's risk. We know that already, but now we're able to see that Genes R Us, yeah, it could be $50 in 5 years. It could also be 50 cents. And then it happens, folks. If you don't believe me, just look at GoPro, right? And they had this whiz bang, fabulous, fantastic product. They still have it, and it was selling like hotcakes until it stopped because there was only so many people who wanted to have the camera on their head as they rode their bike down a single track mountain path and flew over the handlebars and broke 7 ribs. Anyway, so do you understand? I hope so. And as you're going to see examples of these, you're going to see examples of the stalwarts in the worksheets, and hopefully in your research for the bonus assignment for Chapter 6. I hope. And you're going to see examples of companies that are very speculative. And we know what speculative means, right? Gambling. Slide 42. Other valuation models. Now, there are a few others in the book. The residual income model allows us to use earnings instead of dividends. The free cash flow model, which takes the residual income model one step further. And you know what? These are basically variations on what we've been doing already. So we think you have enough on your plate. It's enough with what we've done today and what we've done in the previous two sessions, I hope. But please feel free to go ahead, and if you have any questions, certainly ask me. And if we have time later on, maybe we'll come back to these. But they're variations on what we've already learned, and I think, I hope, what I want you to do is learn these cold, and I'm going to ask you over and over and over again, and then on your own, or contact me, you can move a little further into these two models, okay? Oh, good. Slide 43. Okay, Piano. This is all great. But just where are we supposed to get all this historical information anyway? And just who decides what next year earnings per share, sales per share, cash flow per share, dividends per share, etc., etc., etc. are going to be? Let alone the expected price of a stock in 3 to 5 years? Well, before the internet, do we have a symbol for that yet? B-I? This information was not readily available, folks. Normally you would ask your broker for it, or you would use one of the securities industry's trusted information sources. And traditionally, for decades, the most respected source was the Value Line. Slide 44. Now, we've made, I think, one or two mentions of the Value Line throughout the semester. And now here's where I hope, I beg you, go to the library. Because it ain't cheap. It's $50 a month if you want your own. But go to the library and get lost. In a nice way, of course. Find the Value Line. Find which library has it. And pull it out and just start thumbing through it, and you are going to see that there is literally no end to how much you can learn about companies, folks. There are thousands of companies. Yeah, there's no way one person will ever learn all there is to know about all the companies. The Value Line is still one of the most respected and trusted sources of data and analysis. Traditionally, it was often the only source that many investors used for data and analysis, along with the company's materials, their annual report, their quarterly reports. This was used extensively, and I assume it still is, by the folks in the investment clubs. They're now called, they used to be called National Association of Investors Clubs, I think. National Association of Investors Corporation? But now it's called betterinvesting.org, BetterInvest, because that's their website, Better Investing. And that's what they used. That was it. I mean, along with the, you know, along with their own research and the company's materials. As we said, it's not cheap, but you can get it for free at the various libraries, see the class website. That's one of the things that I love to do. I know it might sound stodgy and old-fashioned and fuddy-duddy for some of you young folks who don't like libraries, but my wife is into historical novels, and I'm into the Value Line, so we go to the library on an afternoon and just get lost. She comes back with 4 or 5 historical novels, and I come back with 4 or 5 or 12 companies that I've researched and gotten ideas from, and then I can't decide on any of them. I'm a big fan of the Value Line, especially the timeliness and safety indicators. One study which ignored transaction costs and tax consequences only used their timeliness indicator. It showed how you would have beaten the market handsomely over a 20-year period by just buying and selling stocks as they received and lost their number one timeliness designation. Now, I'm not telling you to do this, but that was just a cute study that showed, hey, these people, you know, they're not perfect, nobody is, but they're pretty darn good. Slide 45. Can you find the indicators, the price value, the future price projections, the historical data, the cash assets, receivables, inventories, description, analysis of the business, the historical annual rates, the insider institutional buying and selling, the amount of debt and number of shares outstanding, the company's financial strength, stability, price growth, earnings predictability? There's just so much. Now I'm going to show you the sixth edition. There's a reason why I do that, because they jettisoned McGraw-Hill in the seventh and future editions. Why? Because it split into two. It split, the company split into two. But here's the, from the sixth edition. Look at it! And if you're listening to this, I apologize. But if you're looking at it on a small screen, you can't make out anything. But it's a sip from the fire hose. You know, I remember when you were a kid and you want to drink from the water hose. And this is like putting a fire hose in your mouth. But look at this, folks. It shows you the historical data of the sales per share, the cash flow per share, the earnings per share, the dividends per share, and then shows you what they believe they're going to be in 3, 4, 5 years, and then what the price is going to be. See, the target price. This is, you know, this was 2009 when they did this, and they're showing you what they believe it's going to be in 2012, 2013, 2014. Is that cool? It shows you the sales, the operating margin, the depreciation, the net profit. More information than you'll ever be able to use. And then the bottom of the page shows you the quarterly sales, the earnings per share, the quarterly dividends. And then remember the past 5 years of growth rate of the sales, of the cash flow, the earnings. These are all things that we need to do those models, the price models and the dividend discount models. And then they have a fairly, you know, not real extensive, but a pretty good description of what's going on with the company in every one. And then they update them not every couple of weeks. You get a new packet every couple of weeks, but they only update parts of it because it's, you know, hundreds of pages long. And so they keep it up to date, but they're very good, folks. They're actually very, very good company. So let's go to, let's put them to the test, okay? So slide 48. Let's put Valueline to the test, right? In late 2009, the price of McGraw-Hill was $28.73. And the price prediction for early 2013 was in the range from $48 to $68. On February 15th, 2013, McGraw-Hill closed at $44.95. Yeah, so not too bad, huh? And then it continued to do, you know, fairly well. But then, as we said, it broke up into two pieces, so it's no longer the same company. But pretty darn good. When they made this prediction, at the end of 2009, the stock market had rallied from the depths of the 2008-2009 crisis, but many people were still predicting the end of the world. Oh, by the way, some of these same people and others are still predicting the end of the world. I love these websites where they say, "We predicted the 2008 crash." They also predicted the 2003, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And the 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. They're always predicting the crash. And then when it happens, it's, we were right. Yeah. What is this saying? Even a broken clock is right twice every day? Okay, let's take a look at the Valueline predictions from the fourth edition. So here we are in 2005, right? And they're saying it's, $47? They're saying it's going to be anywhere from 64 to 80. What happened, okay? How did they do mid-2005? Their price prediction for late 2009 was in the range from around 66 to 82. The price was hovering around $24 in late 2009. What happened? Well, it had reached $70 by mid-2007. So, again, they were pretty darn close. But then it started to fall as the credit market started reacting to the home mortgage loan crisis. Because at the time, this is before they broke the company up, McGraw-Hill owned Standard & Poor's. You remember them? They're the company that was giving triple A ratings. And what does that mean? Wait till we get the bonds, the best ratings, to these bonds that were tied to the mortgages that people lied about and said they were making $120,000 when they were really making $35,000 and had no hopes of paying after a few years when they went from $1,600 a month to $2,200 a month to $2,800 a month to $3,300 a month. And then we had hundreds of thousands of foreclosures and unemployment spiked at almost 11%. Yes, McGraw-Hill plummeted along with everybody else as the home loan mortgage crisis spread to the entire financial sector. Their mid-2007 prediction was even uglier because, of course, that was right before the organic matter hit the ventilating device. But what about their early 2003 prediction from the third edition, huh? Well, in early 2003, it was selling for $54.49. Now, this is they had a split, so that's why it's higher than it was before. $54.49, and they thought it was going to be worth anywhere between, I don't know, $90 and $110 bucks. So you can take a look at these in more detail. And then on slide 54, we see that in early 2003, the Value Line predicted the price of McGraw-Hill would be around $90 to $110 in 2005 and 2006. Well, why so much higher? They split their stock 2-for-1, so you have to divide these prices by 2 to compare them to the previous two predictions. Hooray for the Value Line! They were bang on the money, because at the end of 2006, they reached a $120 split adjusted level. It was actually 60 bucks, but that's because they split the stock 2-for-1. And if you don't understand that, go back and listen to it again. They just split the stock, so this number of prices go, the number of shares doubles of the stock, and the price falls in half. I get a kick when some investors trash the Value Line as being old-fashioned, fuddy-duddy, the old way of valuing stocks are wrong, it's a new era, it's different this time. All I can say is, look, they make mistakes too, just like everybody else, but I would love to see how these investors' long-term results stack up against the long-term results of the Value Line. Who do you think would have the better results? Also, along with these sheets that they create for every individual stock, there's also a beginning part that talks about their views of the market. They have sample portfolios that they construct for you, very conservative, very aggressive income portfolios. So you can take advantage and use it as you wish. You can do what they do, or you can say, you know what, I like this idea, but maybe instead of Exxon, I'm going to go with Chevron, or maybe instead of Ford, I'm going to take a look at GM. So, check it out. I hope you do. I hope you do. I hope you spend an afternoon at the library and play with the bonus assignment from Chapter 6. Do your best and don't worry about getting it perfect, because we don't want it to be perfect. In fact, we want to avoid precision or avoid perfection. Cool? Okay, have fun with the Value Line. Slide number 55, the bottom line. Once we have finished all our valuation calculations, what should we do? Should we really place much value in our predictions? And dear students, the answer is no. No, 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 no. Rather, we should hurl them into the vast ocean along with the ashes of our dead pets and relatives. We should shred them into millions of little pieces and use them as confetti at our next party. We should burn them under in a huge bonfire as we dance naked under the full moon. Do you see what I'm We do these calculations to simply tilt the odds in our favor. Instead of placing any significance in our calculations, after we have finished, we should ignore them and ask ourselves a very simple question. Do I want to own this company? Is this the kind of company I would want to partner with? Because that's what you're doing. You're becoming a partner. You're becoming part owner. unless you intend on selling it in 3 days or 3 minutes or 3 weeks or whatever, then you're just renting the stock. You're not owning the stock. Peter Lynch, in his book, One Up on Wall Street, which you're going to read, right? Go ahead and read that. It's a great book to read. He said after he had done all his research, he would put it all into a three-ring binder for every company. He had hundreds of these things lying around the office. He would hold up the three-ring binder in his hand and give himself the 90-second pep talk, the story, he called it. He said, this is Pep Boys, or this is whoever the company is. Schmuckers. A boring company that sells jelly and peanut butter. I'm buying this company because of these reasons. Or I'm not buying this company because of these reasons. Or I'm selling this company because the story has changed. You understand? We are doing this simply to tilt the odds in our favor. We do not place any significance in these numbers because we know there's a 90-some percent chance that it's not going to turn out the way we expect it to turn out. But that's okay. We don't have to get it right. All we've got to do is tilt the odds in our favor and the world doesn't end. We'll do okay. No guarantees. Don't come back and yell at me. Because, you know, even with this, oh boy, 2008 was tough. But every time I've done this with large cap companies, it's worked out okay. You know, not always perfect. Sometimes better than what you expect it to work out. Sometimes, as we said, you know, some companies you never expected, just for some odd reason, just explode. Or the story changes and it changes for the better. Or the story changes for the worse and, hey, maybe it's time to sell. Yeah. I think so. And I hope you do also. And if all this seems too much, I don't want this, Payano. That's why there's mutual funds, right? Well done. We are done chapter 6. And I want you to go back and do these again. Do the worksheets. Do them once, twice, three times. Do the assignment. And the exam's going to be exactly the same. Because we're now ready to turn our attention to what is called ratio analysis. And that's, we skipped to chapter 17 where they call it projecting cash flow and earnings, which is part of what we do. We think what's going to be next year. But Benjamin Graham, when you read, don't read it the first book, when you read The Intelligent Investor, I told you this, when you read The Intelligent Investor, you're going to see that Mr. Graham was a big advocate of watching those ratios. And you can't just use one ratio to decide whether to buy or sell a stock, but it creates a very good picture of what's going on. Okay, so that's our next chapter. But welcome, dear students. You now know techniques that most people don't even know exist, and they're not going to guarantee that you're going to be the next Peter Lynch or the next Benjamin Graham or the next Warren Buffett. But it also guarantees that you won't be the next Charles Stedman. Who's he? We'll learn about him in later chapters. Suffice to say, there's a reason why you've never heard of this gentleman. But if you look up Charles Stedman, you'll realize that he is very infamous, and not for very good reasons. See you in our next chapter, dear students. We want you to be awesome. We want you to be the best stock pickers the world has ever seen. We want you to be filthy rich and the guru. You already are the investment guru for your friends, family, and coworkers. See ya!